Today on the program, jobs, of course, what exactly you can do in 6 seconds, and a reminder that capitalism, well, it doesn't really care about you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 1st of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The end of a long week in this economy. Roughest, of course, down in Texas. We'll talk about that in just a bit. Also, Jobs Day, Tax Week, and Congress comes back on Tuesday. Sounds like just about 5 minutes worth of live radio to me. Neela Richardson is at Redfin. Cardiff Garcia is at the aforementioned FT, the FT Alphaville blog. Hey, everybody.
Hi, hey, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you. We'll go to jobs real quick first because I think we probably have to. 156,000 new jobs, less than what everybody had been guessing. Unemployment rate ticks up to 4.4%, so we'll give it a firm meh. I want to touch base on wages, though, with you. Still not going anywhere.
No, they're still stuck. And everyone kind of expected for jobs to underperform. They've always done that in August, at least over the last few years. So that's not surprising. What's still surprising is that wages aren't growing. And that kind of belies all the myths in the jobs market that there's a skills gap and that there's a lot of slack and all this other stuff. What we really need to see improvement in the economy is wage growth, and we're still not seeing it.
Okay, but how come, Neela? I mean, seriously, because this is your thing, right? And we've talked about this now for years, you and I. Why are wages not growing?
The economy is just not as productive as it used to be. Huh. And there's a lot of reasons why that could be. It could be that, you know, there's no new technology that's spurring productivity along. It could be that corporations are not investing enough. It could be that workers have the wrong skills. But it's not something that is attributable to a business cycle, just the natural up and down of the market. There is something seismic happening in the labor market, and it really is going to take some federal level investments to change the trajectory of wages. We can't stay on autopilot anymore and expect wages to go up. We've done that for about 7 or 8 years now.
All right. Fair enough. Cardiff, very quickly, a pass through Janet Yellen's brain. Do we care what the Fed thinks right now?
I think we always care what the Fed thinks. But I mean, in the context of what Neela was just saying and the jobs numbers, this is a very peculiar and kind of precariously balanced time for the U.S. economy, where the jobs numbers obviously were modestly disappointing. The growth numbers, the GDP growth numbers we got earlier this week, were better than expected.
3%,
right?
Yep.
That's right. But inflation is still awfully weak. And so it's a little bit hard to tell exactly where the economy is going. And yet, as far as we can tell, the Fed continues down the same path towards gradually tightening interest rates and shrinking its balance sheet. So, yeah, we should care because this is all happening in real time.
All right. Fair enough. Cardiff, I want to stay with you and go to taxes. President Trump, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, and Chief of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, all spoke this week about taxes. First of all, they say there is a tax plan. What do we know about what the White House wants to do on taxes?
Very little. They haven't offered many details, and it's quite possible that that's because there just aren't any details to offer yet, right? So they're referring to it as a tax plan and as tax reform. It seems like so far they've talked more about tax cuts, right? But we don't know how much they want to cut them. We don't know how much they want to lower, for instance, corporate taxes. And we don't know what Congress will think of it, because right now it looks like the president is in a particularly weak state. In other words, he's being ignored not just by Congress, but also by some people in his own cabinet. And so we really don't know how these negotiations are going to shake out. And they're going to begin during an especially busy legislative month of September. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how these negotiations play out.
Yeah, and that September in Washington is going to be complicated, obviously, by the Harvey relief money and the things that have to be funded. Neela, let me continue with taxes with you for a second and ask you about something. All three men at some point this week said, we want to lower the corporate tax rate in this country. President Trump said, I want it to get to 15%. They said that will put money in workers' pockets. Is that your experience? Is that what happens when corporations pay less tax that workers benefit?
No, there's no evidence of that. And there's been a lot of research out lately that supports that companies that have lower tax rates. Let's get rid of the myth that all companies are paying 35%.
Well, right,
Most companies
are
paying
right.
much less than that. And those that pay, large corporations that pay much, much less than 35% are still not adding jobs in the economy. So that kind of shakes at the assumption that just by lowering the tax rate, we're going to get more jobs. Mm-hmm. Just like adding more jobs will lead to more wages. We haven't seen either of those two things happen yet. And so there are a couple of big bets and assumptions in this cut of the tax rate. One, that we're going to get more jobs from it. And two, that we're going to get a higher growth rate. And none of those things are evident quite yet.
So, Cardiff, pick up on that for a second. And you got 30 seconds to do it in. They are banking on 3% economic growth to make this tax plan and the tax cuts in it pay for itself. Discuss.
Yeah, that is a very aggressive estimate. The evidence, as Neil said, on tax cuts paying for themselves isn't just scant. It's non-existent. That being said, it is theoretically possible that a lower corporate tax rate could lead to a stronger economy and more jobs growth. But it depends on what it's accompanied with, because it has to include closing the kinds of tax loopholes that companies have been able to take advantage of for a very long time. And so really it depends on the whole package and not just the specific lowering of the corporate tax rate.
September is going to be a busy, busy month. Cardiff Garcia at the blog FT Alphaville and Neil Richardson at Redfin. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, traders looked at that jobs report and basically laughed in its face. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit more on the jobs report now, and it starts with this number, 160,571,000, give or take. That's how many people are in the American labor force, says the U.S. Department of Labor. And remember from this morning that today's jobs report said we added 156,000 new jobs last month. Or, if my math is right, a gain of a bit more than 0.09%. A pretty fine slicing of the economy is my point. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more on the August jobs report, Labor Force Context Edition.
Okay, I'm going to throw a couple of numbers at you. For August, we got 24,000 fewer jobs than were expected. In June and July, it went the other way, tens of thousands more jobs than were expected.
The way to think about it is that the jobs report is accurate to plus or minus 100,000.
Betsy Stevenson was chief economist at the Labor Department in the Obama administration.
When they're talking about being below or above expectations by 10,000, 20,000 jobs, these are really small numbers, and the survey's just not designed to give you that kind of precision.
Here's another statistically noisy thing. These first estimates of job creation, they're revised to be more accurate in subsequent months. And Patrick Newport at IHS Market says in late summer, they're kind of lousy.
Since the year 2000, the August number has been revised by an average of 55,000 upward. So if we get a disappointing number in August, just wait a couple of months, you'll probably get a much better number.
Economist Bill Rogers at Rutgers University says we should pretty much ignore whether the job creation number misses the expected number or if one month is high or low.
You know, one data point does not make a trend. You know, try to take a three-month average, a six-month average.
Patrick Newport says going forward, there are demographic shifts that will make prediction harder.
Some of the trends are changing right now. Immigration appears to be slowing down. More recently, there's been an increase in the death rate for white males.
And no one really knows yet if all those baby boomers hitting retirement age will really fully retire. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Senate parliamentarian had some not great news for Republicans in that chamber today. She said that if Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to use reconciliation to repeal Obamacare, that is special budget rules that only require 51 votes to pass something, he's only got until September 30th, the end of the fiscal year, to do it. Elsewhere in the politics of the healthcare economy, the Department of Health and Human Services says it's going to cut the Obamacare advertising budget by 90%, 90%, money that is supposed to be used to encourage people to sign up for the program. It's a decision not without controversy, but given that this is advertising, a notoriously inexact science, we sent Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein in search of the answer to this question. When all that money goes away, is anybody going to notice?
Under the Obama administration, healthcare.gov spent around $100 million on a variety of ads, like this TV spot.
When I'm worried about all the things that might happen, it's hard to live in the moment. Protect the great moments in your life with an affordable health plan through healthcare.gov.
Federal health officials also ran radio commercials, online commercials, and even emails to individuals right before deadline, nudging them to sign up. Do media blitzes make a difference? University of North Carolina's Paul Schaefer looked at what people did after Kentucky's governor pulled ads promoting their state exchange, Connect, in 2015.
They stopped going to the Connect website, they stopped shopping for plans, and ultimately they stopped submitting applications and enrolling.
The Trump administration says, after all these years, people don't need any glossy Obamacare commercials. Beyond cutting the message, the administration is also slashing the budget for navigators, the folks who help consumers sign up for coverage, by 50%.
In the last year, our navigators have fielded 79,938 inquiries.
Shelley Quengam at Palmetto Project in South Carolina says all these cuts will make a difference. It's not clear if states or philanthropists will step in to pick up the advertising or outreach slack. The bottom line, if fewer young and healthy people sign up, the cost of premiums will just rise faster. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
I need to stipulate something here as a preface to this next story. The free market is cold-blooded. It's heartless, really. Supply, demand, prices, they, in normal circumstances, find a balance, consumers adjust, and the economy goes on its merry way. What's going on down in Houston now, though, are not normal circumstances, which is why the Texas Attorney General's office has received almost 2,000 complaints of price gouging since Friday. But a lot of economists, not all of them, but a lot of them, will tell you that those often outrageously high prices can serve a market purpose. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains.
Charging flood victims 30-some bucks for a case of water, $10 for a gallon of gas, doesn't sit right. But many economists will tell you that's just the market at work. Good old supply and demand.
Price gouging laws stand in the way of the normal workings of competitive markets.
Michael Salinger is an economics professor at Boston University and former director of the Bureau of Economics at the Federal Trade Commission. To make his point, Salinger recalls a Dennis the Menace cartoon.
Dennis asks his father what causes tides.
And his father says, the moon. Dennis offers up another explanation.
Well, I think there's a big whale in the middle of the ocean, and when he swishes his tail one way, the tide comes in. When he swishes his tail the other way, the tide goes out.
His father says, you don't really believe that, do you?
And Dennis said, well, you know, I don't, but it makes a lot more sense than the moon.
Letting markets work, allowing price hikes in times of disaster, says Salinger, is the moon answer. It's right, he says, but not intuitive. There are a couple reasons economists don't like laws against price gouging. Let's go back to supply and demand. Michael Giberson is an economics professor at Texas Tech. On the demand side, he says laws that keep prices low can encourage overbuying. They benefit the people who get to the store first.
And if prices don't rise, then they just sort of get plenty.
If water's cheap, I might be tempted to buy as much as I can carry, just in case. If, on the other hand, prices shoot up,
it encourages consumers to be a little more careful in using the goods.
Economists make a supply-side argument here, too.
So when the price of vital goods goes up in an area affected by an emergency, that sends a signal to areas not affected by that emergency to bring more.
Matt Zwolinski is director of University of San Diego's Center for Ethics, Economics, and Public Policy. Zwolinski argues that for both these reasons, both supply and demand, the practice of price gouging can actually be admirable from a purely moral perspective.
And the reason the practice is admirable is simply that it allocates scarce goods and services in a way that best meets human needs.
But as with much of economics, there is disagreement here. What are economists getting wrong when they say anti-price gouging laws are bad? What are they misunderstanding?
They're misunderstanding that if you people off, you pay a price.
Richard Thaler is an economist at the Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago. He co-wrote a well-known paper on price gouging. It looked at what people think is fair.
The paper begins with the following scenario. A hardware store has been selling snow shovels for $15. the morning after a blizzard, they raise the price to $20. Is that fair? And people hate it. They all think that's a terrible idea.
Thaler argues that a business that wants to be in business tomorrow can't raise prices. Come time to rebuild, no one's going to want to buy new flooring from the guy that sold them the generator at double the normal rate. Businesses, economists, he says, should pay more attention to our shared social values.
During a time of crisis is a time for us all to pitch in. It's not a time for us to grab.
We have to think beyond the law of supply and demand, he says, beyond pure economics. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
While the winners were widely spread, for the losers, it tended to be very up close and personal.
The trade-offs of global trade. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. On the first Friday of September, the Dow Industrials up 39 points, about a 10%, finished at 21,987. NASDAQ up 6 points, a 10th there, 64.35. S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 24.76. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.8%, the NASDAQ up 2.7%, best week of the year. Thank you very much. The S&P 500 grew 1.3%. I don't know why I said the year. Automakers drove upwards today. General Motors up 2.2%. Ford finished 2.9% to the good. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.16%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 6 seconds. Not enough time to get up from the couch and grab a snack or a soda from the fridge. Not enough time, clearly, for a trip to the John. But apparently, if you're Fox Sports, 6 seconds is just about right for a television commercial during NFL games this season. Ads that short are pretty much standard for a lot of the content you see online. Not so much on broadcast TV, though. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has more now on the economics of shrinking attention spans.
Broadcast TV advertising space is becoming less valuable. Even viewership for NFL games was down 9% last season.
Television ratings are in decline. Lots of advertising dollars are moving over to digital.
Brian Sheehan teaches advertising at Syracuse University. He says it's no surprise some TV commercials are starting to look more like online ads.
Consumers today are used to snackable content. They're used to being able to look at something in 5 or 6 seconds and get the message.
30 seconds has been the typical TV commercial length for decades. But Nielsen data shows the number of 15-second spots is creeping up over the past few years. Andrew Lipsman at media measurement company Comscore says there's a move to make them even shorter. Most advertisers are fine with that. They already have experience making the shorter ads for the web.
It creates efficiencies for them to be able to now scale their digital ad strategies to TV as well.
It's also good for broadcast networks looking to get the most money out of their available ad time. Fox charges about the same for its 6-second spots as it does for 15 seconds. But Dave Campanelli at media buying agency Horizon Media says it's not just duration. Brands will pay a premium to place their ads in the best slots.
The placement right before kickoff of an NFL game where all eyes are tuned into the game and they're not changing the channel and they're not looking at their phone, there is huge value in that.
Campanelli says to really keep our attention, commercial breaks will have to be shorter, not just individual ads. But if Fox's experiment works out, he says other TV networks will follow. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The second round of NAFTA renegotiations started today down in Mexico City. Talks are supposed to last until Tuesday, unless President Trump pulls the U.S. out of the trade deal before then. I say that tongue-in-cheek, but the president has said more than once in the past week or so that that's what he's planning to do if things don't go the way he wants. NAFTA's probably the best example of the trade agenda in the Trump administration. America first is the phrase that they like to use. Thing is, free trade's never been an easy sell for the American people, because workers, in manufacturing mostly, but others as well, are the ones who take the biggest hit when jobs leave for cheaper labor somewhere else. But recognizing the human cost of globalization has never been our strong suit, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
First, let's listen to this exchange from a 2004 episode of The West Wing.
Do you ever
wonder if we forget the human face of trade, the blood and muscle?
You have to go with what grows the economy for everyone. There's blood and muscle in India, too.
Yeah.
That defense of free trade, that it increases prosperity overall, is something you might have heard from Marina Whitman in the 1970s when she was an economic advisor to Richard Nixon.
There was a lot of concern in those days about competition from the Japanese.
As an executive at GM in the 80s, Whitman still advocated for free trade, even when a flood of imports threatened the American auto industry. She still believes, but says the U.S. has neglected the human costs.
What we didn't pay enough attention to was the fact that while the winners were widely spread, for the losers, it tended to be very up close and personal.
Whitman is now 82 years old and still teaches at the University of Michigan. She says the country hasn't done enough for the people who've lost their jobs to global trade. Government retraining programs are all well-intended, but over the years, they've been criticized as fragmented, too restrictive, and stingy.
We have always tended to be less generous to the losers from any particular change than most other industrialized countries.
And that, Whitman says, has helped fuel the current blowback to free trade. At least one powerful group actually anticipated the kind of backlash we're witnessing today. In the early 70s, the Chamber of Commerce created a task force on how to compensate workers who lose jobs to global trade. The program in place at the time was so narrow that in the first 6 years, not a single American worker qualified. Economist Fred Bergston, now 76, chaired that chamber task force. He remembers the day he delivered his proposals to the chamber's board of directors.
So I entered their sanctum, their boardroom, took the podium. I presented our report. Very, very vigorous debate ensued.
Bergston's report called for more money for more workers, relocation assistance, even money for communities affected by plant closures. But while the plan was great for workers, it created problems for some industries in that chamber boardroom. If the government could really cushion the blow for, say, steel workers who lost jobs to foreign competition, that would make the loss of steel jobs less of a big deal and weaken steel companies' argument for protectionist trade barriers. Bergston says even some free traders in the room worried that a bigger federal program would just draw unwanted attention to the number of Americans losing jobs to trade.
To me, that was dramatic, and we've seen that more or less in the 40-plus years since, where politicians who support free trade are often unwilling to draw the logical inference that you have to take care of the losers if you're going to sustain the free trade politically.
Congress did end up expanding benefits for laid-off workers, but over the years, it's been a half-hearted effort. Edward Alden is author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Alden says retraining eventually was reduced to a kind of bargaining chip in free trade deals.
Thrown out as a kind of carrot to try to buy the votes of a handful of Democrats.
Who worried about backlash from unions. Organized labor has always had mixed feelings about retraining. Unions prefer to focus on preserving the jobs that still exist. But Alden says unions did provide baseline support.
As the unions have weakened, there simply is no effective lobby pushing for stronger workforce support and training programs.
Essentially, retraining and other aid for dislocated workers has never enjoyed a passionate political constituency, which has led to limited support in Congress, which has led to smaller and less effective programs, which has helped fuel resentment against free trade. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we were talking earlier about how the free market can be a cold-blooded son of a gun, supply, demand, price, and all of that. Here's another example. Maybe you've heard of Juicero, the Silicon Valley venture capital-backed company that came to market a couple of years ago with a fancy-schmancy juice squeezer that sold for $700. Oh, and you could only use it with proprietary juice packs the company sold at $7 a whack? Right, that one. Well, after going through $118 million worth of investors' money, Juicero announced today it is shutting down. Capitalism is a cold, cold beast, y'all. All right, we are done. The Dow up 39 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ up 6 points, 10% there as well. S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.